Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Monday morning, the 6th of June, and as always this Monday morning, it's time for All Things Political, and we'll take our topics from the news. You can give us a ring with your questions and comments about the upcoming presidential race, maybe the economy, or whatever's on your mind. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. And you can always weigh in on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, too. We've got a couple of guests this hour, and joining us for the first part is Karen Demulty. She's national political correspondent at the Washington Post. And then at 9:30, we'll be joined by Carl Lubsdorf, who's the former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. And he currently writes a weekly column for the paper and its website, which is www.dallasnews.com. And we'll go to our first guest this morning, Karen Demulty. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Veronica. It's great to be here.
So, of course, as we were listening to the news there, I know you could hear it too, Karen. We heard the latest on the Palin Paul Revere. I guess it's a little bit of a back and forth now. She's not giving in. What do you think about it?
Well, I guess technically we were all British back then, so.
I guess you could try that spin, too. I don't know. I mean.
Yeah, at least the way I recall being taught the Paul Revere ride, he was trying to keep it secret from the British. And I think at one point he was even taken prisoner by the British. So, yeah, it's not a sort of conventional read of American history.
She's a revisionist. But what does she get out of sticking to, and this is a bad metaphor given this, but sticking to her guns about this?
You know, I think she is trying to fight it's the most dangerous thing in politics is when a toxic narrative gets started about a politician. You know, Al Gore was loose with the truth, or George Bush wasn't very bright, those kinds of things. And I think what she's trying to do is essentially sort of pull herself out of one that seems to fit what is becoming a stereotype about Sarah Palin, which is that she speaks often without thinking.
Or that she doesn't have the base of knowledge to back up what she's saying.
Well, yes, that too.
Yeah, well, but she is a Tea Party favorite still, is she not?
She is, and nobody knows quite what this whole bus tour was designed to do. You know, she's flirting with the idea of running for president. She looks maybe a little more serious about it than she did a few weeks ago. But by going to these sites, I think she is kind of putting herself in the middle of this whole debate over American exceptionalism that is really so much in the sort of middle of the Tea Party argument.
Flesh that out a little bit for us. How is she in the middle of that argument?
Well, American exceptionalism is a phrase that until, you know, pretty recently, I think you didn't hear that much outside of, you know, college history courses and academic journals. But it has become a real rallying cry for the right. You hear it from the lips, I think, of just about every Republican who is running for president now. And it is essentially an answer to their argument that they think that Barack Obama has abandoned the idea that this country is unique and was put here by God for a special purpose. And, you know, it harkens back to some comments that the president made early in his term, I think on his first trip overseas, where when he was asked about American exceptionalism, he said, well, you know, the Greeks think they're exceptional, too. And the president, I think, has tried on a number of times to walk that back. But it really has become kind of part of a Republican indictment against him in this election.
Why is that so central to the narrative, at least the political narrative, do you think?
Well, I think it plays into a lot of things that are going on in people's minds. There's a lot of economic anxiety. There is a sense that, you know, America is not as certain of its place in the world as it used to be. And I think that it's kind of a way of trying to give reassurance to people.
And it is at a time, a crossroads, it seems, with the economy, fumbling, and the West in general, the European financial markets following on its heels with those troubles, it does seem as though the West sort of needs to reinvent itself, or at least to remember what it made it great, to feel good about itself, to get that confidence.
And it also comes at a time when, you know, Barack Obama is trying to take this country consciously. It's what one of the things he ran on sort of a more internationalist path, that, you know, his argument was that George Bush was too much of a unilateralist president, too much of a go-it-alone kind of guy. And so I think it also speaks to people who are nervous, too, about what direction that is going.
And I guess for people who are nervous about what direction the country's going in, that's what the next election is for in 2012. We've got the Republican field shaping up now a little bit, taking form. You want to give us a roundup on that?
Well, it's shaping up a little bit, but this Republican field is unique, going back at least a half century and or more, actually. The Gallup poll had an interesting study a few weeks back where they pointed out that in every single Republican race, with the exception of one since 1952, there has been a front runner at this point with a double digit lead.
Really?
Yeah. And that is, you know, not the case this time. Mitt Romney is probably ranking top of most polls, but he's still right around or under 20% in the polls. There is not this kind of a breakout candidate like we've normally seen. Now, that, you know, that front runner doesn't always get the nomination, but he almost always gets it. An exception was 4 years ago when it looked like Rudy Giuliani was the front runner. But generally, the Republicans settle early on who they're going to nominate. It's, you know, a much more orderly process than we normally see from the Democrats.
Well, it's interesting. How much do you think that has to do with the killing of Osama bin Laden? I guess, if anything.
This was the case before that, even. I think that one of the things that it suggests is that the whole race is getting started a little bit later than we've seen in the past. You know, by this point, last time around, you know, all the candidates you had, some, you know, were in the race. They were opening up field offices. They had, you know, a lot of them declared in December and January of December of 2006 and January of 2007 and February of 2007. So the race is getting started later. And also, I think the Tea Party has really kind of roiled Republican politics. I think there is now this kind of insurgency within the Republican base that has changed everyone's calculations.
And how do you think that's going to play out? I mean, I've been hearing conflicting things. Some people have said the Tea Party has lost steam. You're not seeing people at the rallies. And other people say, no, that's because they're working. They're really hitting the streets. They're being involved in the legislative process. What is your take on that?
Well, I don't know if the Tea Party itself is losing steam. But the fact is, the kind of insurgent energy that the Tea Party represented, I don't think is losing steam. And, you know, there will be a candidate in there somewhere who will appeal to that sort of anger and frustration with bigger government and deficit spending. I mean, that's one of the reasons, for instance, that you now hear the entire argument in Washington is about cutting spending. And that, I think, is a great victory for the Tea Party.
They've changed the dialogue.
Absolutely. And with so many new members in Congress who are there because of the Tea Party, it's become, you know, to the point where in the Republican caucus, especially in the House, the safest vote is no on anything that has money attached to it. And that's why we have this big, you know, this big debate over whether or not to raise the debt ceiling.
So in terms of a Tea Party candidate, do you see that as something that would be divisive to the GOP, or something that everyone is just going to have to get on board with if they prevail?
Well, it depends on whether the establishment candidates, and here I'm thinking about people like Mitt Romney, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, possibly John Huntsman, whether they can develop a language that speaks to the Tea Party insurgency. And if they cannot, that really does provide at least a temporary opening for people like Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin or even possibly Newt Gingrich, although his start out of the gate didn't go so well.
I guess it's too early to tell you who you think looks strongest, but who do you think looks strongest?
Well, you know, if history is any guide, you would have to put your money on somebody like Mitt Romney or possibly Tim Pawlenty. But, you know, I'm surprised at the number of Republicans who, I mean, people who are very much in the, you know, money-raising and organizing game who say they're not so sure the field is even set yet, that they think there may be another candidate somewhere along the line, that maybe a Rick Perry will step in. I've even heard talk that maybe John Thune, the senator from South Dakota, might be rethinking his decision not to run.
Let's move to the economy now, if we can. The news is not good. The unemployment rate jumped up to 9.1. Do you want to kind of summarize what that latest report said?
Well, you know, it suggests that the recovery, if it is happening even more slowly than all of us had thought and all of us had hoped. And that, politically speaking, is going to be a problem for the president because the fact is that re-elections are as much a referendum on the incumbent as they are a choice. As much as the White House and the Obama campaign are going to try to make this a choice, what is going to drive it is how people feel about how well Barack Obama has performed in office.
You think it won't be somewhat, is the recovery working? Is it all a mirage? You know, Obama has been selling America on this idea that it is a slow, steady climb, kind of telling us, be patient. It's happening. You just have to have a little faith. But if the numbers aren't backing that up, it's sort of all in the numbers, isn't it?
Well, I think what it's going to be is how people feel about their lives. As Ronald Reagan so famously put it in 1980, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And that is something that it is measured in the data. But as pollsters will tell you, as much as anything, it's whether people feel like things are improving and whether they are going to continue to improve.
Optimism.
Yeah, and also, you look around and are you surrounded by foreclosed houses and, can your kid get a job coming out of college or do you have a job?
Well, and that was another point of the report that apparently home sales have yet to hit or home prices have yet to hit bottom. And that's very bad news.
Well, given the fact that, for most people that home is their biggest investment and it is their most tangible, evidence of economic well-being. And, a lot of people, as it's been documented, did a lot of really stupid things in the real estate market. And it is still sorting that out.
Our guest this hour, or for the first half hour, is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent at The Washington Post. And we'll start digging into your phone calls and your emails next. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking all things political this hour, the upcoming presidential race, the economy, and whatever else might be on your mind. 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Monday morning, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. I hope you'll stay tuned next hour as we talk about what should be on your summer reading list with a reviewer and editor from Publishers Weekly. This hour, it's all things political, and our guest is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent at The Washington Post. And we'll take our first caller now. We have with us Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I think the Democrats have done a poor job of framing the issue in terms of jobs and the debt. And what they need to do to point out is that the Republicans and the big business community could help the solution of both aspects of the problems, but they obstruct and sabotage the solution. And to understand this, you have to understand the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy and ripple effect. In the self-fulfilling prophecy, you say there's going to be a problem, but you don't mention your part in creating the problem. You don't mention your part in obstructing government creation of jobs, which would help solve the problem, and you don't mention the fact that you exacerbate the problem by laying off government employees. And the ripple effect, you throw a stone in the water, the effects radiate outward. Now, if you look at it logically, the corporations in America have been gathering in record profits, but they've done limited job creation. In fact, a lot of times they've exported jobs, continue to export jobs overseas. Now, the effect of the ripple effect of all of this is that when people are laid off, they draw unemployment compensation and welfare. They go to the emergency room, which costs money, and they're not creating. They're depleting revenues, and at the same time, they're not paying taxes, which create revenues, and they don't have discretionary money to spend, which could help create other jobs. So, in the whole process of things, when people are out of work, obviously you don't have money coming in, and you can't create jobs, and you can't help bring down the debt. And the Republicans, by their obstruction and refusal to create jobs, which it seems to me is the patriotic duty of the corporations, especially considering their record profits, because of this obstruction, we have a continuing problem. And then they piously sit back and say, well, you see, I told you so.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Jim. Karen, have the Democrats done a poor job of explaining what's going on?
Well, I think that a number of Democratic strategists think so. They think that the White House in particular has not had kind of a consistent message on jobs and on the economy, and that, you know, a lot of other stuff has come up and kind of created static in the system as well. So, you know, there's certainly a need to convey, I think, to people that this White House is, in fact, focused on the economy almost exclusively. And part of it, quite frankly, is, you know, just the media environment and the media culture that we're in, where, you know, the big story one week can be Donald Trump and the next one can be Sarah Palin's bus tour. And that, I think, also makes it, you know, a little bit more difficult for other people, because, you know, who wants to discuss the ins and outs of the debt ceiling on cable television when, you know, there's a congressman who's accused of sending naughty pictures on his Twitter feed.
Okay, thank you for that call, Jim. We appreciate it. And we move to another Jim from La Crosse. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Following up on the former Jim's question, the Republicans have done a pretty good job of you know, attacking President Obama's plans to try to stimulate the economy, and that's with the stimulus. So what I'm wondering, and I don't know if I could hear this from the source of a journalist or if she's familiar with what economists would say, have we failed by not enlarging that stimulus, by expanding that stimulus to help us get through this incredible recession? Because it seems that history would show that there was a need for increased government spending to get us through this, but the Republicans have made it look like, well, we have major problems and deficits already, which is true, but those are kind of deficits over a long period of time versus the short-term deficit that might help us. So any insight on that?
Well, I think Jim has a good point here. There are two conversations going on here. One is on the short-term problem, but there's also a real long-term problem. And even, you know, I think some people like Alice Rivlin, the Democrat who's the former head of the Congressional Budget Office, very well-respected authority on these things. I think that because people don't feel as though we've gotten serious enough about tackling the long-term problems, they're not confident in government to be spending a lot in the short term. And you're absolutely right. I think most economists do believe that, you know, some government spending could boost growth a bit. But again, it's because of these long-term problems that people don't have the confidence that it would take to support that kind of thing.
Well, thank you for your call, Jim. We appreciate it. And we go to Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Morning.
First of all, I do not subscribe to cable TV. I don't get Fox or these other news channels. That being said, I get most of my news from what people call the mainstream media, maybe network news, and also NPR, PBS, things like that. But I am just, I guess, shocked at the over-coverage of Sarah Palin. I just can't get over the fact that every time I listen to any news show lately, it's Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin. I'm saying to myself, why are we hearing that name? And it's kind of like she's kind of like a gaper's block for an accident. You know, it's kind of like an accident out there watching what she's doing. Maybe that's the attraction. But it brings to mind, for a while, the media was focused on this Donald Trump issue. And I was watching a panel show. It might have been Face the Nation or something, one of those morning shows. And the panel was somewhat talking about Donald Trump. And Tavis Smiley was on the panel, and he's one of the most reputable, I would call, news people out there in my mind. And he basically said to the other people, he said, you know, he's just playing you. He's just playing the media. And I think that's what's happening with Sarah Palin. And I kind of call her the Britney Spears of politics, and it seems like the media is compelled to that they have to tell us everything she does, and I'm just wondering why.
Well, she's got a lot of star power, and I guess even that question, why are we hearing so much about Sarah Palin, has been the subject of news stories in the media. Why are we hearing so much of Sarah Palin is the headline in the papers, too. What do you think, Karen?
Well, what I can tell you is that people, believe it or not, do want to see and read and hear about her. I can tell you that watching the web traffic of the Washington Post, every time we write anything about her, the number of web hits goes through the ceiling. So, you know, on the one hand, you can say the media is overdoing it, and I absolutely agree. But on the other, the internet gives us a way to measure what our readers want to know about better than we've ever had before, and in real time. So it's kind of a dilemma for, I think, the mainstream media. She drives numbers.
So people want to hear about her. There's a huge demand for hungry Sarah Palin readers, but why, I guess, is the underlying question.
They love to argue about her. And she understands this, by the way. She understands kind of her own star power better than anyone. So, and she knows that, you know, she can make or break a candidate with a well-timed tweet. You know, she can raise money for, you look at somebody like Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, was considered absolutely, you know, a longer than a long shot until Sarah Palin all of a sudden endorsed her. Now she's the governor. She does have some power in these things.
See, let's maybe we have time for one more call before we have to let you go, and we'll take Bill's call from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'm living in fear because I'm old enough to have enough history behind me to see enough world events. The Japanese thought that they were exceptional because of the, you know, the gods put a specific role for Japan. Japan was special. The Germans thought they were special. They used racial arguments to support it. The United States wants to think itself exceptional. That's how Ronald Reagan got into office. You know, it's moving in America, you know, and Sarah Palin is putting out that message. And if she can hit the right tone, I'm afraid that not only will she win, but I think that it will really pave the way for essentially a fascist government in the United States that will be extremely aggressive on the world stage and be the ultimate ruin of this country. I just, you know, am I just paranoid or am I crazy or what? But I'm really afraid of what this could morph into.
All right, thank you.
Off the air.
All right, thank you, Bill. And Bill, getting at some of the ambivalence out there, some of the debate that you're talking about.
Well, though American exceptionalism as a concept is something that goes at least as far back as Tocqueville in the early 1800s. And, you know, interestingly enough, it was used by Marxist scholars in the 19th century to explain why it is that a socialist movement and a real labor movement never developed in this country. So the concept itself has been out there for a long time, but it is being politicized, I think, in a way that we haven't seen.
Well, Karen Tumulty, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Veronica. It's been great to be here.
Karen Tumulty, our guest for the first half hour of the program, national political correspondent at The Washington Post. And we welcome now our next guest. Carl Lubsdorf is the former Washington bureau chief at the Dallas Morning News, and he currently writes a weekly column for the paper and its website, dallasnews.com. And Carl Lubsdorf, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Veronica.
And just to segue into our next topic, or the current topic, we've been talking a little bit about the idea of American exceptionalism and how that has been playing out in the current administration, the Obama administration, where he was sort of backpedaling from that idea, and whether some of the GOP candidates are going to want to return to that trope and help reassure America. What do you think?
Well, you certainly see here some of the Republican presidential candidates talking a lot about it. I'm not sure exactly that it's totally correct that the Obama administration backpedaled from it. I mean, they've tried basically to maintain the idea, but also say that they're, you know, we're not the only ones, basically. And the Republicans have accused them of basically abandoning the idea, and then think of it's sort of an issue in Republican circles, whether it's an issue as a national issue, I think, is not clear yet.
How do you think the major issues for the GOP field are going to emerge? What do you see as being the primary thing that the narrative, I guess, for that race?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, at the moment, of course, they're all talking about the economy and about the slow recovery, and mostly giving an exaggerated picture of what's going on. To hear them talk, you think that Obama created the recession and that his policies made it worse. And the Democratic view, of course, is that he inherited the recession, and which the statistics certainly show, and that his policies have prevented it from getting worse. Now, it's a little hard to prove how much worse things would be without the stimulus and other legislation that was passed, but anyway, that's what that argument is. We're going to find out a lot more about the Republicans, I think, and the interplay between them a week from today, when we have the first really major debate on the Republican side. There was one in South Carolina last month, but very few of the candidates participated. The one next week, which is in New Hampshire, and it's going to be on CNN, brings in most of the current field. Former Governor Huntsman of Utah says he's not a declared candidate yet and won't be there for that. But we're going to see, Tim Pawlenty and Romney and Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain and, you know, Rick Santorum. So we're going to see the bulk of those who are currently running. And it's going to be interesting to see whether they spend the whole time beating up on President Obama or try to, you know, create some differences between themselves.
Well, at this stage of the game, isn't it usually the prudent course to kind of try to knock the other guy out and worry about Obama later?
Well, except that we think that there is not a great deal of difference on issues between them. And, you know, when they speak to Republican audiences, of course, beating up on the other side is a, you know, gets good reaction. And you saw last week in Governor Romney's announcement in New Hampshire, the clips that got the attention were basically the ones that said Obama was a failure. That's where he got the applause lines from that crowd. He did not talk at all about the other candidates. No, he's sort of acting as if he were the front runner, which to some degree he is, although by all historical standards a fairly weak front runner. But he's been around the track before. He's got is going to raise a lot of money, will probably have one of the best organized and staffed campaigns, and is certainly the early favorite in New Hampshire, which is one of the key early tests.
Just want to give out our number one more time. We do have an open line for you for your question about the upcoming race, the GOP field, how the Democrats are preparing, and, of course, the economy. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk at WPR.org. And I want to ask you, Carl, what is your take on how the Obama administration has been shaping up? Obviously, he's got a country to run. Is he doing sort of what previous sitting presidents have done in the lead-up?
You mean politically?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I think it's very similar. There's a very similar pattern. They've started on the early side, but they've started raising money. They have a goal to raise $60 million, I think, in this quarter. They're doing one thing that is unusual for an incumbent president. The campaign headquarters is going to be in Chicago, not in Washington.
Oh, that is interesting.
We see other, you know, challenger candidates often have put their headquarters outside Washington, both for the symbolism of it and also for the convenience and keep the costs down. But for incumbent, there's not been an incumbent that I know of who actually put his headquarters in Chicago, and some question how that'll work. But, you know, he has a strong base of support there and a lot of, you know, can get a lot of help there. And it also keeps it a little bit under the radar, although there's, you know, probably not much secret to what they're doing. They're doing pretty much what they did last time, which is organizing support and setting up the structure for it in the key states needed to be elected. Obviously, they're not have to focus on a primary opponent because they won't have one. But we know which are the key general election states. We know they're in the Midwest, and we know there are states like Virginia and North Carolina, which the president carried last time, and some of the Rocky Mountain states with the large Hispanic populations like New Mexico and Colorado and Nevada. So, you know, we can see that there will be, as we go forward, I think, a lot of emphasis in those states. But it's sort of, you know, the pattern is for a president running for re-election to basically spend most of his time doing his day job and doing fundraising and stuff like that at night. And he's been to a number of fundraisers. But when anything comes up about the campaign, they refer, I think, you know, the campaign will talk for and the White House will concentrate on, you know, legislation and foreign policy and all that stuff.
What do you think needs to happen with the economy to assure Obama's win? I mean, do you think even with this, you know, we had some disappointing numbers recently about unemployment and home prices. Do you think if that kind of news continues, he'll be more vulnerable, or will he be able to, do you think, spin a narrative, maybe spin's
well,
wrong word?
But historically, he certainly appears to be vulnerable that way. There's a statistic going around that no president's been reelected when when unemployment was above 7.2%, which it was in when Reagan was reelected. It almost certainly will be above 7.2%. I think the administration would be happy if it were down in the neighborhood of 8%. I think we just don't know. You know, we know that that's a problem, and we know that that has an effect on the president's job approval. How much effect it will have on his reelection chances in the end is impossible to predict at this point. For one thing, we don't know what the state of the economy will be a year from now, and I think it's generally felt that the state of the economy in the second quarter going into the third quarter of the election year is the crucial time for that. The administration's hope, obviously, is that the improvement which occurred all through last year and into this year, which is now slowed down, will begin to pick up some steam again. They have figures on the number of jobs that have been created since the economy hit bottom, and that obviously has to continue. But clearly the economy next year will not be all that great, and it could will be a detriment to President Obama's reelection.
And how big a bump will the Osama bin Laden factor be?
Well, it's interesting. Statistically, in the polling, it had a instant bump, most of which wore off pretty quickly. There's a story about Obama in USA Today, and in the interest of full disclosure, it was written by my wife, Susan Page of USA Today, and she notes in it that Obama's job approval in the Gallup tracking, which they do every night, was 46 before Osama bin Laden was captured. It went up to 52, and it yesterday was 47. So In that sense, there hasn't been an improvement. I think I'd make the case that it's probably had more of a beneficial effect as a long-term factor. And there was the Republicans may have been making headway with this idea of Obama as an indecisive leader. Of course, last year they were saying he was trying to do too much and was too strong. And this, I think, certainly reinforced the idea of him being decisive and a strong leader. And it will give them a major talking point when we get into the campaign. And one of the issues is, what have you done? Well, one of the things he did was, on his watch, Osama bin Laden was killed. And, of course, in the 8 years of Republicans before he took over, that did not happen. So I think it's still a major plus, but how much, again, remains to be seen.
We're talking all things political this hour with our guest Carl Lubsdorf, the former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. Currently, Lubsdorf writes a weekly column for the paper and its website, which is dallasnews.com. And we're looking forward to hearing from more of you this hour, what's on your mind in the political landscape in America. And, of course, we can look abroad, too, if there's something there that catches your eye from the headlines. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's Talk of the Nation. Today, immigration crackdown on employers is one topic, and also the new New York Times editor. That's coming up at 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest for all things political this hour is Carl Lubsdorf, the former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News, and he now writes a weekly column for the paper and its website. Take our next call now. We've got Jeff from Winneconne with us. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. Let's talk about Sarah Palin. I mean, star power, Charlie Sheen. Everyone is just waiting for a train wreck with Sarah Palin. That's the reason why she has star power. And, you got to look at Paul Ryan, too. I'd like to ask you a question about him. Why is he not running? Because he would lose hands down.
Okay, thank you. And Carl, what do you think?
Well, there's several things in there. I think that all signs are that Paul Ryan would not, would have a tough time getting elected president. And we know that his budget is very controversial and is maybe a big negative for the Republicans. I mean, the Republicans appear to have forgotten about one of the basic rules of American politics, which is that Medicare is extremely popular, and if you take it on, that is a political loser. It's sort of like, forgetting about history, forgetting about the last time the Republicans regained control of Congress in the mid-1990s. They've, had problems with trying to cut Medicare also. But I think Paul Ryan's main interest is in the House and is in Congress. He's a legislator. He's quite busy, I think, has a lot to do there and not much time and interest in running for president. Sarah Palin is, of course, the fascinating figure in this campaign. She's a colorful and interesting figure for more reasons than as a train wreck waiting to happen. She is a very dramatic figure. She has a great, she has a certain strong following, and she's got more pizzazz and more oomph than most of these Republican candidates. Now, what's interesting is, of course, the fact that no one seems to have any idea, except for Ms. Palin and perhaps her husband, what she's up to here. She did manage to step on Mitt Romney's announcement. We suspect that she's not quite enamored of the idea that Michelle Bachmann might emerge as a candidate with some of the same appeal that she has. But the general consensus seems to be that she is, in fact, not going to run for president, but she's very unconventional, and we just don't know. The poll numbers say that she, is unelectable in a general election, but she definitely has appeal to a certain segment of the Republican Party, and it's especially a segment that is strong in the Iowa caucuses, which will be the first important specific test for the campaign next year.
And you're a big believer in those first two caucuses, the importance.
Well, I think the importance of the first of the Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire primary, is what everyone thinks of the process there, and there's been criticism of the Iowa process, especially because it really caters to the activists in both parties. The Democratic turnout actually last time was quite big. It was bigger than they normally have in gubernatorial primaries. But in any case, it caters to the activists, and neither state is really a typical state demographically. But historically, those two tests do play an important role in winnowing down the field. And unless you show real strength in one or the other of those states, it is very difficult to win the nomination. And we've seen that over and over again, that John McCain didn't do much in Iowa, but he won the New Hampshire primary, and that catapulted him into South Carolina. Now, the South Carolina primary, which is the second primary after New Hampshire, its winner has been the nominee every time since they had a South Carolina primary in 1980. But to be a strong candidate in South Carolina, you almost certainly have had to do something in either Iowa or New Hampshire. So most of these candidates who are currently running will not do well enough in Iowa and New Hampshire to sustain their candidacies. And while the process is different this time, the fact is they'll need them after those early states. You need a lot of money to compete in the bigger states like Florida and Michigan and eventually Illinois and California and Pennsylvania. And unless you've done well early, the candidates are going to have trouble raising that money.
Let's go back to our phones now. We have Patrick joining us from Fox Valley. Hi, Patrick.
Your guest is from Texas, so I'm curious he'd be willing to comment on the appeal of, I think the governor's last name is Perry. What appeal does he have to the Republican Party in the primary?
Well, I work for the paper and have worked for the paper in Washington, not in Texas, but I know Governor Perry and have talked to him over the years. In fact, another piece of disclosure, he made me an honorary admiral in the Texas Navy several years ago. I think he has a fair amount of appeal to Republicans, frankly. He's got a state where the economy is good. He's been able to keep taxes low and block any tax increases. He certainly fits the Republican on the social issues. And he's got more of a persona, I think, than some of the people who are running. He sort of has that rugged rancher Marlboro man appeal that Ronald Reagan had. Now, whether he knows as much and would be as smart on issues as Reagan was, we don't know, and that will see him tested. He's not had to work too hard to win and keep his office over the years. He's had close elections, but he's not been, some people feel he's not the most energetic of campaigners. And running for president is pretty tough. Now, he, of course, changed his position recently. He'd been saying forever that he had no intention of going to Washington, no intention of running. Now he says he's going to consider it. I think most people think in the end he probably won't run. Some people think he'd like to be the Tea Party candidate for vice president, who, like if Governor Romney gets nominated, the Tea Party has enough influence to get one of its own on the ticket, that he might have a chance. The state's a little bit too Republican, it seems to me, to make him a good vice presidential candidate without having done well in the Republican contest. But I think he has a fair amount of appeal to Republicans. He's also talked about secession, which seems to many people like a sort of an odd thing if you're trying to be president, but there's a lot of support for that notion within Republicans, sort of anti-Washington stance. He was actually a Democrat starting out, like many Southerners, Southern conservative. He was actually Al Gore's state chairman in 1988. But since then, he's run for and been elected to statewide office 6 times as a Republican. So stronger in the Republican Party than in a general election. I think he'd have a very difficult time in a general election, but with some appeal to Republicans.
Wait, explain the secession notion that you mentioned. What is that?
The what?
Secession notion, you said.
Well, he's talked about that maybe the way to deal with a powerful federal government is for states to secede. He just sort of floated the idea. He hasn't pushed it very far, but it's and there is a school of
is that rhetoric?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
Pretty dramatic thing to say, though.
Well, and it's an odd thing, especially if you want to run for national office.
a little contradictory.
There is a whole secession. There is, in fact, a whole secessionist movement out there. People who feel that one of the problems in the country is the country's too big and the government can't handle its problems and things would be much better if states or localities handled them. It's not a very feasible idea, but it does exist in certain quarters.
But there are other people using that same language?
Well, there are. There is a sort of an organization out there encouraging it. They even had a convention of people from different states who were in favor of it. I know a little about this because an old college friend of mine is involved in this. But in fact, I don't think Perry was very serious about it. It was one of those things you say sometimes, and it's not realistic to think it's going to happen. The states still depend a lot on the federal government. If they had to, do things on their own, I think that would be pretty difficult.
Right, to say the least, yeah. Let's see. Let's take another email. Here is an email from Maureen in Madison, who says, how much impact does the guest feel that Karl Rove and the Koch brothers' political groups will have in 2012?
Well, they're going to raise a lot of money. And, money is mother's milk of politics. So I think that's, it does give the Republican Party a source of a lot of money. They spent a lot of money in the congressional election last year, although I'm not sure we can argue that that's why the Republicans did well. And the Democrats are setting up a similar kind of operation, basically, to appeal to rich Democrats to give money that can be used to help vulnerable candidates. Money, the more that efforts are made to sort of limit the use of money and spending too much in politics, the less successful they seem to be. And while presidential candidates can only raise a certain amount of money per person, the fact is that they can set up organizations in a way that they can get as much as they can spend, and campaigns, are prone to spend as much as they can raise. Now, sometimes it costs them a lot to raise the money. I read that Michelle Bachmann, who's been a pretty successful fundraiser so far, her costs in raising money have been fairly high. But that's going to enable her to play in the first part of the race, and, of course, how she does there will determine what she's going to do elsewhere. But so Karl Rove wants to exercise a continuing influence in the Republican Party, and he and a number of other Republican leaders have encouraged these kinds. I think their group is called American Crossroads. They spent a lot of money in that recent New York congressional election, but unsuccessfully, as it turned out. And both sides are going to have plenty of money. The fact is.
Well, I'm curious about what you think about the Koch brothers, because I read the long piece in the New York Times that ran a while back. And apparently, if you read that media, they like to operate in secrecy. And now they're sort of out in the front and center stage now. You see demonstrations centered around the Koch brothers. Is that going to matter? Or is it just about the money?
I think they do have some influence, with some of the candidates they support. And it's not solely there's a reason they want to elect Republicans, is because Republicans are more likely to pass tax policies and energy policies that they favor and that are good for their companies. I think all of this has some effect, but I think it's sort of like we get to the point where many candidates are spending enormous amounts of money, the kind we would not have expected some time ago, but the opposition is countering them. I've always felt that money makes its really biggest difference the further down you go the ballot and the further down you go to candidates that the public doesn't know very well, whether it's state legislative candidates or in some places even congressional candidates. The public in presidential campaigns, well, money does play a factor, and the Obama money that they were able to raise last time was certainly helpful. The fact is the public gets a pretty good idea whom it wants to elect as president. It knows a lot about them. They're very high profile. We have the debates. We have, various things that get them out before the public, and the public pretty much decides, you know, whom it wants, and that person gets elected. And I don't think, you know, money has had effect in some primaries, in helping certain nominees. If we go back about 20 years, a little more, when Congressman Dick Gephardt ran from Missouri and was running against, among others, Michael Dukakis. Gephardt had never run statewide and had trouble raising money and competing. Money was a factor in Michael Dukakis winning that nomination. George Bush, when he ran for president the first time, the son of the former president, he had some financial advantages over other Republicans. But I say in general elections, basically, I think that it's not the determining factor.
Well, real quickly, we only have about 30 seconds for your answer, but the new New York Times editor, you know, you're a journalist in the print industry. What do you think about that direction the paper's taking?
Well, I know Jill Abramson well. I've known her over the years as a reporter. We actually went to the same high school in New York, a private school in New York called Fieldston. We appeared on a panel there some years ago. I'm delighted for her and for the paper. She certainly got where she got on merit. She was an outstanding reporter and editor, and it does reflect the way things have changed. You know, a generation ago, all these jobs were held by white males, but the nature of the press corps has changed, and many women have done very well.
And I'm sorry we have to leave it there. We're out of time, but Carl Lubsdorf, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to do it.
Carl Lubsdorf, former bureau chief, Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.